Shadows of Resilience. Chapter 1. Roots in Turmoil. Jeremiah Steele was born in the rural outskirts of Hollow Creek, Ohio, in 1931, a time when racial tensions gripped the nation. His family lived in a modest farmhouse surrounded by acres of farmland, their days filled with hard work and dreams of a brighter future. His mother, Lizette, had emigrated from Trinidad as a young woman. She carried with her a rich cultural heritage, teaching Jeremiah and his siblings the value of resilience and unity. His father, Marcus Steele, was a towering figure in the community, known for his unwavering commitment to racial equality. Marcus often hosted meetings in their home, discussing strategies for uplifting Black families in the area. Education and economic independence, he would say, are the keys to our freedom. Marcus's speeches inspired many, but they also made him a target for the local chapter of the Black Hand Legion, a notorious white supremacist group that operated in the shadows. One cold November night, Jeremiah awoke to the sound of breaking glass and the acrid smell of smoke. Flames engulfed their small home as shadows moved outside. His father's voice boomed through the chaos, urging everyone to escape. "Get out through the back! Now!" Marcus shouted. The family stumbled into the frosty night, coughing and gasping for air. In the distance, Jeremiah caught sight of men in hoods retreating into the darkness. Hours later, the smoldering ruins of their home lay in silence, but the true horror was yet to come. Marcus was missing. Days later, his body was found near the railway tracks. The sheriff's office ruled his death a suicide, dismissing the clear evidence of foul play. The community mourned in whispers, too afraid to confront the perpetrators. Jeremiah, only 8 years old, felt the weight of injustice for the first time. The loss devastated Lizette. Once a pillar of strength, she fell into a deep depression. Her once vibrant eyes grew hollow, and her laughter faded into silence. Jeremiah tried to comfort her, but as months turned into years, her mental state deteriorated further. By 1935, she was committed to Hollow Creek Asylum, leaving Jeremiah and his five siblings to fend for themselves. The children were placed in separate foster homes, a decision that fractured the family. Jeremiah, sent to live with the rigidly religious Whitefields, struggled to adjust to his new environment. Despite the hardship, he excelled in school, fueled by a deep desire to honor his father's legacy. At Hollow Creek Elementary, he earned top marks and impressed his teachers with his sharp mind and eloquence. "You'll be a great man one day," one teacher told him after a classroom debate. Jeremiah clung to that hope, envisioning himself as a lawyer fighting for justice. But the world had other plans. In eighth grade, during a career day exercise, Jeremiah confidently declared, "I'm going to be a lawyer." His teacher, Mr. Hastings, chuckled and shook his head. "Jeremiah, you're bright. But let's be realistic. The law is no place for someone like you." The classroom fell silent. Jeremiah felt the sting of humiliation, but more than that, a simmering anger began to brew. That night, as he lay in bed, his father's words echoed in his mind. "Never let anyone tell you what you can't do." From that moment, Jeremiah resolved to prove everyone wrong. But the path ahead was far more treacherous than he could have imagined. Chapter 2. Echoes of a Broken Dream. By 1943, Jeremiah Steele had left the quiet fields of Hollow Creek behind and found himself in the bustling, chaotic streets of Southside Chicago. At just 17, he was a young man trying to carve out a life in a city alive with energy but steeped in inequality. The Southside pulsed with jazz, the scent of fried food from street vendors, and the endless chatter of people hustling to make ends meet. For Jeremiah, it was both freedom and a reminder of the struggles he could not escape. He stayed in a boarding house run by a widowed woman named Mrs. Henderson, who took pity on him and allowed him to pay rent late as long as he did his share of chores. Jeremiah found work hauling crates at the docks during the day, his muscles growing stronger with each grueling shift. By night, he wandered the streets, drawn to the music and the promise of something more. Meeting Eloise. One evening, while walking past a dimly lit jazz club, Jeremiah noticed a striking young woman with auburn hair standing against the wall. She wore a sleek red dress, that caught the glow of the streetlights, and her confident stance exuded an air of rebellion. Eloise Carter was unlike anyone Jeremiah had ever met, a white girl from the affluent suburbs, fearless and unbothered by the stares she attracted in a predominantly black neighborhood. "You're staring, farm boy," she teased, smirking as Jeremiah tried to gather his composure. "I wasn't staring," he replied, though his flushed cheeks betrayed him. "Just wondering why someone like you is here." "Maybe I like trouble," she said, stepping closer. "What's your name?" "Jeremiah," he said, still wary. "What's yours?" "Eloise. But you can call me Trouble." From that night on, the two became inseparable. Eloise introduced Jeremiah to a world he had only glimpsed from the outside. Smoky bars, backroom poker games, and parties filled with people who lived by their own rules. For the first time, Jeremiah felt alive, unbound by the expectations that had weighed on him for so long. The connection to Vinny. Through Eloise, Jeremiah met Vincent "Vinny" Morales, a charismatic Puerto Rican gangster who ran an illegal numbers game. Vinny had a reputation as a man who could make anything happen for a price. Eloise vouched for Jeremiah, and Vinny, impressed by his sharp mind and knack for calculations, brought him into the operation. The work was dangerous but exhilarating. Jeremiah handled the numbers with precision, earning Vinny's trust and respect. The money was good, better than anything he had ever made hauling crates, and for the first time, he allowed himself to dream of a life beyond mere survival. "Kid, you've got a talent," Vinny told him one night over a glass of whiskey. "Stick with me, and you'll never have to work a day in your life." Jeremiah knew better than to trust a man like Vinny completely, but he couldn't deny the appeal of the fast money and the power that came with it. Rising tensions. As the months passed, Jeremiah's confidence grew. He became a fixture in Vinny's inner circle, trusted to handle large sums of money and coordinate the network of runners who kept the operation alive. But success bred tension. One evening, after a particularly lucrative run, Jeremiah claimed to have bet on the winning number himself, a claim that would have entitled him to a substantial payout. "You're mistaken, kid," Vinny said, his tone icy. "I don't recall you placing that bet." "I'm not mistaken," Jeremiah shot back, his voice firm. "You owe me." The room fell silent. Jeremiah felt the eyes of the other men on him, waiting to see how he would handle the challenge. Vinny leaned back in his chair, his gaze piercing. "Careful, Jeremiah. You're valuable to me, but not that valuable." The words hung in the air like a warning. Jeremiah dropped the matter, but the trust between him and Vinny had been irreparably damaged. The escape. The situation came to a head one fateful night when Jeremiah narrowly escaped an ambush. He had been walking home from a late meeting when he noticed a car following him. The sharp bark of a gunshot shattered the night, and Jeremiah dove into an alley, his heart pounding. He sprinted through the maze-like streets, eventually losing his pursuers. Panting and drenched in sweat, he knew he couldn't stay in Chicago any longer. Vinny had marked him as a liability, and staying meant certain death. Jeremiah packed what little he owned and boarded the first train heading east. As the city faded behind him, he felt a pang of regret, but also a flicker of hope. He didn't know what lay ahead, but he was determined to survive. Chapter 3. Numbers and Betrayals. Jeremiah Steele's return to Ohio marked a reluctant retreat, but it wasn't a surrender. He had left Chicago alive, but the weight of betrayal clung to him. The South Side streets had taught him lessons in loyalty, power, and deceit. Lessons he could not unlearn. Back in Hollow Creek, he found himself face to face with the ghosts of his past, but also with an old friend who would set the stage for his next chapter. Reuniting with Sam. Samuel "Sam" Brooks had been Jeremiah's closest friend during their childhood in Hollow Creek. When Jeremiah returned to the small, quiet town, Sam was working as a mechanic, scraping by with little ambition but a keen mind. Sam had always been a risk-taker, the kind of person who saw opportunity in chaos. "Jeremiah Steele," Sam said with a broad grin, wiping grease from his hands when Jeremiah stepped into the garage. "Look at you. City life hasn't killed you yet, huh?" "Not for lack of trying," Jeremiah replied, shaking Sam's hand. "But I need a fresh start, and I figured Hollow Creek's as good a place as any. The two fell into easy camaraderie, sharing stories over cheap beer in Sam's cramped apartment. It wasn't long before Jeremiah confided in Sam about his time in Chicago, the numbers game, and the dangerous fallout with Vinny. Sam listened intently, his mind already working on a plan. "You know, we could do it better," Sam said one night, his voice low and serious. "No middlemen, no gangsters skimming off the top. Just us." Jeremiah hesitated. "I came back here to lay low, not to make more enemies." "Think about it," Sam pressed. "We keep it small, keep it quiet, and we don't need the city. We can start here, in Hollow Creek." The plan. Jeremiah eventually agreed, swayed by Sam's persistence and his own restless ambition. The two began their venture by quietly setting up a numbers racket, targeting the few black neighborhoods in the area. Jeremiah's sharp intellect and Sam's resourcefulness made them an effective team. To avoid suspicion, they worked under the cover of a legitimate front, a small bar owned by Clara, Sam's longtime girlfriend. Clara was fiercely loyal to Sam, though she harbored a quiet admiration for Jeremiah's calm confidence. Together, the trio formed a tight-knit operation, keeping their activities under the radar. At first, the scheme was successful. Jeremiah and Sam built a steady clientele, earning more money in weeks than Sam had seen in years. Clara's bar became a hub for their business, with patrons discreetly placing bets while pretending to enjoy drinks and pool games. Enter Eloise. Jeremiah had hoped to leave Eloise Carter behind in Chicago, but she had other plans. One afternoon, while he was counting earnings in the back room of the bar, Eloise walked in, her presence as commanding as ever. She wore a fitted coat and a sly smile that betrayed her satisfaction at having tracked him down. "Miss me, farm boy," she teased, tossing her coat onto a chair. Jeremiah froze. "What are you doing here?" "Looking for you, obviously. You didn't think I'd let you disappear that easily, did you?" Her arrival complicated everything. Sam was wary of Eloise, sensing the danger she carried with her. But Clara, sensing the tension between Jeremiah and Eloise, kept her distance, focusing on her role in the operation. Despite his reservations, Jeremiah couldn't deny Eloise's usefulness. She had a way of drawing in high-paying clients, her charm and audacity making her an asset they couldn't ignore. Cracks in the foundation. As their operation grew, so did the risks. By the summer of 1945, their small racket had drawn the attention of local law enforcement. Though careful to avoid detection, the group knew they couldn't stay under the radar forever. Eloise's recklessness began to strain the partnership. She would take dangerous risks, often flaunting her involvement in the racket at upscale bars and clubs. Jeremiah confronted her one evening after she showed up drunk to a meeting. "You're going to get us all caught," he said, his voice low but firm. "You need to stop drawing attention to yourself." "Relax, Jeremiah," Eloise replied with a dismissive wave. "No one's looking at me. They're too busy underestimating me." Her words carried a kernel of truth, but Jeremiah knew better. Attention was a liability they couldn't afford. Tensions boiled over one night when Clara caught Eloise flirting with Jeremiah after hours. The confrontation was heated, with Clara accusing Eloise of trying to sabotage their operation. Sam tried to mediate, but the damage was done. The group's once solid trust began to crumble. The betrayal. The breaking point came when Jeremiah discovered that Sam had been skimming money from their earnings to fund a side venture without telling him. Furious, Jeremiah confronted Sam in the back room of the bar, slamming a wad of cash onto the table. "What the hell is this?" Jeremiah demanded. Sam looked guilty but defiant. "I was going to tell you, Jay. I just needed a little extra to get things moving." "Moving where? We're supposed to be a team." Jeremiah's voice rose, the betrayal cutting deeper than he expected. "Maybe I'm tired of being the sidekick," Sam shot back. "You think you're the only one who deserves a way out?" The argument escalated, with both men exchanging harsh words. Clara, caught in the middle, pleaded for them to stop, but it was too late. The bond they had built was irreparably damaged. Escape again. Jeremiah knew the operation was doomed. The trust was gone, and the authorities were closing in. One night, He packed his belongings and left Hollow Creek, without a word, once again running from the wreckage of his own creation. As the train carried him away from the town that had shaped so much of his life, Jeremiah felt a familiar mixture of regret and determination. He didn't know where he was going, but one thing was certain. He wasn't going to let the mistakes of the past define his future. Chapter 4: Crime and Consequences. The train rattled through the night, carrying Jeremiah Steele away from Hollow Creek and into the unknown. His destination was Boston, a city he had heard whispers about in Chicago, bustling, diverse, and full of opportunity for someone willing to take risks. Jeremiah arrived with little more than the clothes on his back and the resolve to rebuild his life. But the shadows of his past followed him, and he quickly discovered that escaping the streets wasn't as simple as leaving town. The Boston Crew. Boston's South End was a patchwork of immigrant communities, bustling markets, and hidden crime rings. Jeremiah found himself in a neighborhood teeming with life and opportunity. It was there that he met William Shorty Lawrence, a quick-talking barber with a talent for finding trouble. Shorty had a knack for spotting potential, and he saw something in Jeremiah. "You look like you know how to handle yourself," Shorty said one afternoon as he shaped up Jeremiah's hair in his modest barbershop. "I could use a guy like you." "For what?" Jeremiah asked, skeptical. "Let's just say I've got a side hustle," Shorty replied with a smirk. "Pays better than cutting hair, that's for sure." Shorty introduced Jeremiah to Peg, a sharp-eyed pickpocket, and Eloise, yes, Eloise, who had somehow managed to track Jeremiah down once again. Her arrival was a surprise, but she came bearing an offer. She had connections in Boston that could help them all. Despite his misgivings, Jeremiah agreed to work with her once more, forming a new crew with Shorty and Peg. The heist plan. The group quickly moved from petty theft to more ambitious plans, breaking into wealthy homes and businesses. Boston's affluent Back Bay neighborhood became their primary target, and Eloise's charm proved invaluable. She would infiltrate high society gatherings, gathering intelligence on potential marks. Peg handled reconnaissance, while Jeremiah and Shorty executed the heists with precision. Their system was efficient, and over the next year, the crew amassed a small fortune. They sold stolen goods through a network of black market dealers, carefully avoiding patterns that might draw police attention. For Jeremiah, the money was more than a means of survival. It was a chance to build something bigger. He began dreaming of buying his own business, a legitimate enterprise that would allow him to leave the criminal world behind. Success breeds danger. By 1946, the crew had established a reputation as one of Boston's most elusive groups of thieves. Their success, however, attracted unwanted attention. A string of high-profile robberies had the Boston Police Department scrambling for answers, and tensions within the crew began to rise. Eloise, always eager for the thrill, pushed for riskier jobs. "We're just getting started," she said one night as the group divided their latest haul. "Imagine what we could do if we hit the banks." "Banks are a different game," Jeremiah warned. "Too many eyes, too many risks." "We can handle it," Eloise insisted, her confidence bordering on arrogance. Shorty sided with Jeremiah, urging caution. Peg, caught in the middle, remained silent but increasingly uneasy about the group's growing notoriety. The fall. The crew's downfall came during a robbery that should have been routine, a wealthy lawyer's estate in Beacon Hill. Eloise had assured them the house would be empty, but they underestimated the security measures in place. As Jeremiah and Shorty slipped through the second-floor window, alarms blared, flooding the night with sound. Peg, stationed outside as the lookout, panicked and fled, leaving the others to fend for themselves. Police arrived within minutes. Jeremiah and Shorty scrambled to escape, but their luck ran out. Officers surrounded the property, guns drawn. Eloise, waiting in the getaway car, sped off the moment she saw the flashing lights, leaving them behind. Jeremiah and Shorty were arrested on the spot. Peg and Eloise were picked up days later, their faces plastered across newspapers as part of Boston's most wanted crew. Sentencing and reflection. In court, the group's fate was sealed. Eloise and Peg, as first-time offenders, received lighter sentences of 2 years each. Jeremiah and Shorty, with their extensive records, were handed 8 to 10 years in a state penitentiary. As the judge read the sentence, Jeremiah's mind raced. This wasn't the end he had imagined for himself, but he couldn't deny his part in it. Prison was a harsh reality, but Jeremiah resolved to use his time wisely. He immersed himself in books, studying everything from history to philosophy. Despite the bleakness of his surroundings, he felt a flicker of hope. He refused to let the system break him. The arrival of Elijah Baines. It was in the dimly lit prison library that Jeremiah met Elijah Baines, a wiry, intense man with piercing eyes. Baines was unlike anyone Jeremiah had encountered, calm, articulate, and deeply spiritual. He introduced himself during a discussion about civil rights, quoting a line from a book Jeremiah was reading. "The oppressed have nothing to lose but their chains," Baines said, sliding into the seat across from Jeremiah. "And who's going to break them?" Jeremiah replied, intrigued. Baines smiled. "We will, if we're willing to wake up." Over the following weeks, Baines shared the teachings of the Brotherhood of Freedom, a movement advocating for racial pride, discipline, and self-determination. Jeremiah was skeptical at first, but Baines's passion was infectious. The more they talked, the more Jeremiah found himself questioning the life he had lived and the systems that had shaped it. A new direction. Under Baines's mentorship, Jeremiah began to see the world through a different lens. He rejected the name Steele, viewing it as a remnant of a legacy forced upon his ancestors by their oppressors. Inspired by the Brotherhood's teachings, he adopted the name Jeremiah X, symbolizing the unknown identity stolen from his family by slavery. Prison became more than a punishment. It became a crucible for transformation. Jeremiah emerged as a man with a renewed sense of purpose, determined to fight for justice not through crime, but through action and enlightenment. Chapter 5. Awakening Behind Bars. Jeremiah X's journey within the cold, unyielding walls of Maplewood State Penitentiary began with an unease he couldn't shake. The clang of steel doors and the hollow, monotonous rhythm of prison life pressed down on him like a suffocating weight. But beneath the surface of despair, a seed of transformation was beginning to take root. Elijah Baines, the enigmatic leader of the Brotherhood of Freedom, had ignited something in Jeremiah, a questioning of his place in the world and the forces that shaped his identity. The Brotherhood of Freedom. Elijah Baines wasn't just another inmate. He was a man of conviction, a walking contradiction of calm demeanor and fiery rhetoric. To the untrained eye, he seemed like a quiet observer. But those who knew him, or listened to him, understood his power. His words had the ability to carve through doubt, leaving nothing but clarity in their wake. During their first official meeting in the prison yard, Baines invited Jeremiah to join a small group of inmates gathered near the edge of the basketball court. There, under the watchful eyes of guards, Baines spoke of a broken system that had enslaved not just bodies, but minds. "They want you to believe this is all you're worth," Baines said, gesturing to the gray, lifeless prison around them. "But the truth is, they're afraid of what we could be if we realized our potential." Jeremiah listened intently. At first, he was skeptical, wary of being drawn into another system of belief after so many betrayals. But Baines's message resonated. The Brotherhood of Freedom wasn't just a religious group. It was a movement for liberation, rooted in a deep understanding of history, power, and identity. A new identity. In the weeks that followed, Jeremiah became a fixture in the Brotherhood's gatherings. Through discussions, readings, and meditations, he began to peel back the layers of his own life, examining the choices that had led him here. Baines challenged him to confront his own past. "Your name, Steele, is a lie," Baines said one afternoon as they sat in the library. "It's the name of your ancestors' oppressors. Do you even know who you are?" Jeremiah shook his head. "No, I don't." "Then claim the unknown," Baines said. "Call yourself X. It represents the identity that was stolen from you, the history they erased." The simplicity of the idea struck Jeremiah deeply. For the first time, he felt a sense of agency, a way to reclaim the narrative of his life. From that day forward, he introduced himself as Jeremiah X, a man no longer bound by the name of his oppressors. The power of knowledge. Jeremiah threw himself into his studies, devouring books on history, philosophy, and political movements. He spent hours in the library, poring over the works of Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, and more. Each page was a revelation, a piece of a puzzle he hadn't known existed. One book in particular left a lasting impact, The Souls of Black Folk by Du Bois. The concept of double consciousness, the idea that Black Americans must navigate life with a dual awareness of how they see themselves and how they are seen by others, resonated deeply with Jeremiah. "They've trained us to see ourselves through their eyes," Baines said during one of their discussions. "But what happens when we start looking at ourselves through our own eyes?" Jeremiah's voice was quiet but resolute. "We become unstoppable, transforming pain into purpose." The Brotherhood encouraged its members to view incarceration not as an end, but as an opportunity. Baines often spoke of prison as a crucible, a place where men could be forged into leaders if they chose to rise above their circumstances. "Pain is a tool," Baines told Jeremiah one day as they walked the perimeter of the yard. "It can destroy you, or it can sharpen you. The choice is yours." Jeremiah took those words to heart. He began mentoring younger inmates, sharing his knowledge, and encouraging them to see beyond the prison walls. He organized study groups, teaching literacy and history to those who had been denied education. Slowly, the Brotherhood's influence spread, transforming the atmosphere of the prison. Conflicts within and without. Not everyone welcomed the Brotherhood's teachings. The prison administration viewed them as a threat, keeping a close watch on their activities. Meanwhile, other inmates, particularly those involved in gangs, saw the Brotherhood as competition for power. One day, tensions boiled over in the cafeteria. A group of gang members approached Jeremiah and Baines as they sat discussing a recent speech by Marcus Garvey. The leader of the group, a burly man named Reggie, sneered. "What's all this talk about freedom?" Reggie said, leaning over the table. "You think reading books is going to get you out of here?" Jeremiah met his gaze calmly. "Freedom starts in the mind," he said. "Maybe you should try it sometime." Reggie laughed, but there was an edge of discomfort in his tone. "You better watch yourself, preacher boy," he said before walking away. The confrontation rattled Jeremiah, but Baines reassured him. "They only mock what they fear," he said. "Keep your focus. Letters to the outside." As Jeremiah's understanding of the Brotherhood's teachings deepened, he began corresponding with supporters of the movement outside the prison. His letters were filled with reflections on identity, justice, and the need for change. These writings found their way into the hands of activists and scholars, earning Jeremiah a reputation as a rising voice in the fight for racial equality. One letter, in particular, stood out. "The chains they place on our bodies are temporary, but the chains they place on our minds can last generations. It is our duty to break those chains, not just for ourselves, but for those who come after us. If we can transform pain into purpose, we can turn prisons into classrooms and oppression into strength. The road ahead." By 1952, Jeremiah had spent 6 years behind bars, but he was no longer the same man who had entered the prison. He had found a sense of purpose, a clarity that transcended his circumstances. When news of his upcoming parole reached him, he felt both excitement and trepidation. Freedom was within his grasp, but he knew the world outside would test him in ways he couldn't yet imagine. Before his release, Baines pulled him aside. "Remember, the fight doesn't end when you walk out those gates," he said. "If anything, it gets harder. But I believe in you." Jeremiah nodded, his voice steady. "I won't let you down." As he stepped into the sunlight on the day of his release, Jeremiah X felt a surge of determination. He was no longer a man running from his past. He was a man ready to confront the future. Chapter 6, The New Path. The sunlight was blinding as Jeremiah X stepped out of Maplewood State Penitentiary in the summer of 1952. The weight of 6 years behind bars was still heavy on his shoulders, but his resolve burned brighter than ever. He wasn't the same man who had walked into those gray walls. Gone was the Jeremiah Steele who had been consumed by crime and anger. He was now Jeremiah X, a man reborn with a purpose: to spread the teachings of the Brotherhood of Freedom and inspire others to rise above oppression. Arrival in Atlanta. Jeremiah's first destination after his release was Atlanta, the heart of the Brotherhood of Freedom. Elijah Baines had spoken often of the city as a hub for black intellectualism and activism, and it was there that Jeremiah would meet Mustafa Kareem, the enigmatic leader of the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood's headquarters was housed in a modest building on a quiet street. Inside, Jeremiah found a hive of activity, men and women organizing rallies, drafting speeches, and distributing literature. The energy was palpable, a stark contrast to the suffocating silence of prison life. Mustafa Kareem was nothing like Jeremiah had imagined. He was a tall, slender man with a calm demeanor, his piercing gaze seeming to look straight into a person's soul. When Jeremiah was ushered into his office, Mustafa greeted him with a firm handshake and a knowing smile. "You've come a long way, Jeremiah," Mustafa said, motioning for him to sit. "Elijah speaks highly of you." "He's been a good teacher," Jeremiah replied. "But I still have a lot to learn." "Good," Mustafa said, "because the world outside these walls is even more dangerous than the one you just left. And if you're not careful, it will devour you." Building a movement. Under Mustafa's guidance, Jeremiah began his work with the Brotherhood in earnest. He traveled across the South, speaking at churches, community centers, and universities. His speeches were fiery and impassioned, calling for black pride, economic independence, and unity in the face of systemic oppression. "Every dollar we spend in their stores is a vote for our own chains," Jeremiah declared at a rally in Birmingham. "Every time we bow our heads in silence, we give them permission to trample on our dignity. It's time to stand up, not with violence, but with discipline and determination." Crowds gathered wherever Jeremiah spoke, drawn by his charisma and the raw authenticity of his message. He wasn't preaching abstract ideals. He was speaking from lived experience, and people could feel it. Confronting resistance. Not everyone welcomed Jeremiah's message. Local authorities often disrupted Brotherhood events, accusing them of inciting unrest. Jeremiah and his team were arrested multiple times on charges ranging from trespassing to disturbing the peace. Each time, the arrests only fueled their determination. One night in Montgomery, after being released from jail following a protest, Jeremiah found himself in a heated argument with a young man in the Brotherhood. "We can't keep turning the other cheek," the man said, his voice shaking with anger. "They beat us, they kill us, and all we do is march and talk." Jeremiah placed a hand on the man's shoulder. "I know your anger," he said. "I've lived it, but violence isn't the answer. It's what they expect from us. We have to be smarter than that." The young man looked unconvinced, but nodded reluctantly. Jeremiah knew it wouldn't be the last time he faced such doubts, even within his own ranks. Meeting Diane Carter. In 1953, during a Brotherhood event in New York City, Jeremiah met Diane Carter, a nurse with a passion for social justice. Diane was intelligent, kind, and unafraid to challenge Jeremiah's ideas, a quality that both frustrated and fascinated him. "Your speeches are powerful," Diane said after one of his rallies. "But power isn't enough. People need action. They need solutions. And what would you suggest?" Jeremiah asked, intrigued. "Start small," she said. "Help families build businesses. Teach people how to organize. Words inspire, but actions change lives." Their conversations grew longer and more personal, and over the next few months, Jeremiah and Diane fell in love. In the spring of 1954, they were married in a quiet ceremony, surrounded by friends from the Brotherhood. Diane became Jeremiah's anchor, offering him both emotional support and practical advice as he navigated the challenges of his growing influence. The growth of the Brotherhood. By 1956, the Brotherhood of Freedom had grown into a national movement, with chapters in major cities across the country. Jeremiah, now one of its most prominent leaders, was often on the road, delivering speeches and organizing events. He also became a mentor to younger activists, teaching them the principles of discipline and self-reliance. "The enemy wants us to react with chaos," he would say. "But we must respond with order. That's how we win." Despite the Brotherhood's success, internal divisions began to surface. Some members believed that the organization needed to adopt a more militant stance, while others felt that Mustafa Kareem's leadership was becoming too authoritarian. Jeremiah found himself caught in the middle, trying to bridge the growing rift. A rising star, Jeremiah's popularity brought both admiration and scrutiny. The media began to take notice, often portraying him as a polarizing figure. Supporters hailed him as a champion of justice, while critics accused him of stirring racial tensions. During a televised interview in 1957, a reporter asked Jeremiah, "Do you believe that your movement is encouraging division in this country?" Jeremiah's response was measured but firm. "This country has been divided since its founding, divided by race, by class, by power. We're not creating the division, we're exposing it. And until we confront it, there can be no healing." The interview made headlines, further solidifying Jeremiah's status as a national figure. The strains of leadership. As the years passed, the demands of leadership began to take their toll on Jeremiah. He missed Diane and their two young children, who remained in Atlanta while he traveled. The weight of expectations, both from within the Brotherhood and from the public, was immense. One evening, during a rare visit home, Jeremiah confided in Diane. "Sometimes I wonder if I'm doing enough," he admitted. "If all this is really making a difference." Diane took his hand. "You may not see the results right away," she said, "but you're planting seeds, and one day, they'll grow into something bigger than any of us." Her words renewed his resolve. Jeremiah knew the road ahead would be long and difficult, but he was determined to see it through. Chapter 7: Love and Loyalty. By 1958, Jeremiah X stood at the crossroads of his personal and professional life. The Brotherhood of Freedom had grown into a powerful national movement, with thousands of members united under its banner. Jeremiah was at the heart of it all, a magnetic leader whose words inspired both hope and fear. Yet, behind the fiery speeches and tireless organizing, his personal life was beginning to strain under the weight of his responsibilities. Family and sacrifice. Jeremiah's wife, Diane Carter, had always been his unwavering support. She had stood by him when he was fresh out of prison, helping him navigate the challenges of building a life outside the walls of incarceration. But the demands of his leadership role meant long absences, and Diane was left to shoulder the burden of raising their two young children, Samuel and Lila. During one rare evening at home in Atlanta, Jeremiah sat with Diane at the kitchen table, the glow of a single lamp casting long shadows across the room. "You're never here," Diane said softly, her voice tinged with both sadness and understanding. "The kids miss you." "I miss you." Jeremiah reached for her hand. "I know, Diane. I hate being away from you. But the work, it's bigger than me. It's bigger than us." "I know that too," she replied, her eyes searching his. "But just don't forget why you're doing this. Don't forget what we're fighting for." Jeremiah nodded, guilt gnawing at him. He promised himself he would find a way to balance his family life with his mission, though deep down he knew it would never be easy. Challenges within the Brotherhood. Even as the Brotherhood of Freedom expanded, cracks began to form within the organization. The movement's success had attracted individuals with differing visions for its future. Some believed in Jeremiah's approach of disciplined, peaceful resistance, while others advocated for more militant tactics, arguing that the time for talking had passed. One evening, during a leadership meeting at the Brotherhood's headquarters, tensions boiled over. Malik Graham, a fiery young leader from the Detroit chapter, stood and challenged Jeremiah directly. "With all due respect, Brother Jeremiah," Malik said, his voice firm, "your speeches are powerful, but they're not enough. Our people are being beaten, lynched, and killed every day. How much longer are we supposed to wait before we fight back?" Jeremiah met Malik's gaze, his expression calm but resolute. "I understand your anger, Brother Malik, but violence is what they expect from us. It's what they want. If we resort to their methods, we lose the moral high ground. We lose the very thing that makes us stronger than them." The room was silent for a moment before Malik replied, "And what if peace isn't enough?" Jeremiah sighed, recognizing the deep frustration behind Malik's words. "Then we keep pushing," he said. "We keep fighting, not with our fists, but with our minds, our voices, and our unity. That's how we win." The debate underscored the growing divide within the Brotherhood, a rift that Jeremiah feared would only deepen over time. love rekindled. Amid the chaos of his public life, Jeremiah found solace in Diane's unwavering love. During a quiet weekend at home, the couple took their children to a nearby park. It was a rare moment of normalcy, a chance to simply be a family without the weight of the movement hanging over them. As Samuel and Lila chased each other across the grass, Jeremiah and Diane sat on a bench, watching their laughter fill the air. "You know," Diane said, leaning her head against Jeremiah's shoulder, "I don't care if the whole world sees you as a leader. To me, you'll always just be the man I fell in love with." Jeremiah smiled, wrapping his arm around her. "And to me, you'll always be the woman who saved me." The simplicity of the moment reminded Jeremiah of what he was fighting for, not just for his family, but for families across the country who deserved the same peace and happiness. The pressure of fame. By late 1958, Jeremiah's fame had reached new heights. His speeches drew massive crowds, and his face appeared on the covers of magazines and newspapers. With fame came scrutiny, and Jeremiah found himself under constant surveillance by the FBI. The agency viewed the Brotherhood as a potential threat to national security, labeling it a radical organization. One night, as Jeremiah prepared for a rally in Birmingham, a colleague handed him a thick envelope. Inside were photocopies of FBI surveillance reports, detailing his movements and conversations. "They're watching everything," the colleague said grimly. "They want to bring you down." Jeremiah skimmed the pages, his jaw tightening. "Let them watch," he said. "I'm not hiding anything." But the pressure of being under constant scrutiny began to wear on him. Every phone call, every meeting, every interaction felt like it was being monitored. The weight of leadership grew heavier with each passing day. A betrayal of principles. It was during this time that Jeremiah began to notice inconsistencies in the actions of Mustafa Karim, the Brotherhood's leader. Rumors circulated about Mustafa engaging in behavior that contradicted the principles he preached: extramarital affairs, financial improprieties, and a growing authoritarian approach to leadership. Jeremiah confronted Mustafa during a private meeting in Atlanta. "Brother Mustafa, the people look to you as an example," Jeremiah said, his voice steady but firm. "If these rumors are true, they could destroy everything we've built." Mustafa's expression hardened. "Be careful, Jeremiah," he warned. "You may have risen far, but don't forget who gave you the platform to speak." The conversation left Jeremiah shaken. He had devoted years of his life to the Brotherhood, but the cracks in its foundation were becoming harder to ignore. For the first time, he began to question whether the movement's leadership was truly aligned with its mission. A turning point. As 1958 drew to a close, Jeremiah found himself at a crossroads. The pressures of leadership, the strain on his family, and the growing divisions within the Brotherhood weighed heavily on him. Yet he refused to give up. He resolved to continue fighting for justice, even if it meant challenging the very organization that had given him a voice. "I didn't come this far to stop now," Jeremiah told Diane one evening as they sat together on the porch. "If the Brotherhood has lost its way, then I'll find a new path. But I won't stop fighting." Diane nodded, her faith in him unwavering. "Whatever path you choose, I'll be right beside you." With her support, Jeremiah prepared for the battles ahead, knowing that his journey was far from over. Chapter 8. Fractures Within. By 1960, the Brotherhood of Freedom was a towering symbol of hope for many. Yet internally, it was crumbling under the weight of ambition, betrayal, and diverging ideologies. Jeremiah X, now one of its most prominent leaders, found himself navigating a storm of conflict, both within the organization and in the broader fight for justice. As cracks widened within the Brotherhood, Jeremiah's resolve to stay true to its principles was tested like never before. The seeds of division. The Brotherhood had grown into a sprawling movement, with chapters across the nation and tens of thousands of members. While its message of black empowerment and self-reliance resonated deeply, the rapid expansion brought competing visions for its future. Some members called for a stronger focus on grassroots organizing and economic independence. Others, emboldened by the rising tide of civil unrest across the country, argued for more militant tactics. Malik Graham, the fiery leader from Detroit, was at the forefront of the militant faction. at a leadership summit in Atlanta, he made his case before the Brotherhood's top leaders. "We've been patient long enough," Malik declared, his voice ringing through the crowded meeting hall. "They beat us, lynch us, and burn our communities to the ground. How much more are we supposed to take? The time for words is over. It's time to fight back." Jeremiah rose to respond, his tone measured but firm. "I understand your anger, Brother Malik, but violence will only give them an excuse to destroy us. Our strength lies in our discipline, our ability to outthink them, not to stoop to their level." The room erupted into heated debate, with leaders taking sides. Mustafa Karim, the Brotherhood's enigmatic leader, remained silent, his expression unreadable. The erosion of trust. Behind the scenes, Jeremiah's unease with Mustafa Karim continued to grow. The rumors of Mustafa's extramarital affairs and misuse of Brotherhood funds were no longer whispers, but undeniable truths. Jeremiah struggled with the implications. Mustafa had been a mentor, a guiding force in his transformation, but his hypocrisy threatened to undermine everything the Brotherhood stood for. During a private meeting in Atlanta, Jeremiah confronted Mustafa directly. "Brother Mustafa, we've built this movement on principles of integrity and accountability," Jeremiah said. "If we don't hold ourselves to those standards, how can we expect others to follow us?" Mustafa leaned back in his chair, his expression cold. "Be careful, Jeremiah. Your ambition is showing." "It's not ambition," Jeremiah replied, his voice steady. "It's responsibility. The people deserve better." The tension between the two men was palpable. Jeremiah left the meeting with a heavy heart, knowing that his days within the Brotherhood's inner circle might be numbered. A shattered alliance. As tensions within the Brotherhood escalated, so did the external pressures. The FBI intensified its surveillance of the organization, branding it a radical group. Agents infiltrated chapters, sowing distrust and spreading misinformation. The government's aim was clear: to fracture the Brotherhood from within. One evening, Jeremiah received an anonymous tip that members of the Detroit chapter, led by Malik Graham, were planning an unsanctioned armed demonstration. Alarmed, Jeremiah traveled to Detroit to intervene. "You can't do this, Malik," Jeremiah said during a tense meeting with the chapter's leadership. "If you go through with this, you'll not only endanger yourselves but everyone connected to the Brotherhood." Malik bristled. "You've lost your edge, Jeremiah. You talk about discipline and unity, but all you're doing is holding us back." "This isn't about holding anyone back," Jeremiah replied. "It's about strategy. They're waiting for us to slip up so they can justify their violence. Don't give them that opportunity." Despite Jeremiah's pleas, the demonstration went ahead. It ended in disaster, with several participants killed and dozens arrested. The fallout further deepened the divisions within the Brotherhood, leaving Jeremiah questioning whether the organization could survive. A glimpse of a new path. Amid the turmoil, Jeremiah found solace in Diane and their children. During one rare weekend at home, Diane encouraged him to consider an alternative path. "The Brotherhood has done incredible things," Diane said as they sat on the porch, watching Samuel and Lila play in the yard. "But if it's losing its way, maybe it's time to think about what comes next." Jeremiah looked at her, his brow furrowed. "I've dedicated my life to this, Diane. Walking away feels like giving up." "Walking away isn't giving up," Diane replied. "It's recognizing when something no longer serves its purpose. Maybe it's time to build something new, something that aligns with your values." Her words planted a seed in Jeremiah's mind. For the first time, he began to envision a movement that wasn't tied to the Brotherhood's internal conflicts but focused on unity, education, and empowerment. Breaking away. In early 1961, Jeremiah made the difficult decision to step back from his leadership role within the Brotherhood. He announced his departure during a press conference in New York City, addressing both the public and the organization's members. "I owe a great debt to the Brotherhood of Freedom," Jeremiah said, his voice steady but emotional. "It has been my home, my teacher, and my family. But I can no longer ignore the divisions that threaten to undermine its mission. I am stepping away not out of anger, but out of love for the Brotherhood, for our people, and for the principles we stand for. This is not the end of my fight. It is only the beginning of a new chapter." The announcement sent shockwaves through the Brotherhood and the broader civil rights movement. Some viewed Jeremiah's departure as a betrayal, while others saw it as a courageous stand for integrity, a vision for the future. In the months that followed, Jeremiah began laying the groundwork for a new organization, the Unity Movement for Justice. Unlike the Brotherhood, the Unity Movement focused on building bridges between different communities, emphasizing education, economic development, and cross-cultural collaboration. Jeremiah's speeches took on a new tone, blending his fiery passion with a message of reconciliation and hope. "We are stronger together than we are apart," he told a crowd in Philadelphia. "Our differences are not a weakness, they are a strength. But we must learn to see each other not as enemies, but as allies in the fight for justice." The Unity Movement quickly gained traction, attracting members from diverse backgrounds. For Jeremiah, it was a chance to start fresh, unburdened by the fractures that had plagued the Brotherhood. The price of change. Jeremiah's decision to leave the Brotherhood came at a cost. Many of his former allies turned against him, accusing him of abandoning the cause. Mustafa Karim publicly denounced him, calling his departure a betrayal of the movement. The backlash was painful, but Jeremiah refused to let it deter him. With Diane by his side and a new vision guiding him, he pressed forward, determined to create a movement that could withstand the challenges of the time. Chapter 9. The Turning Point. The year was 1963, and America was boiling with unrest. Protests swept through the streets of Birmingham, Detroit, and Washington as the cries for civil rights grew louder and more desperate. Jeremiah X stood at the forefront of this turbulent era, now the leader of the Unity Movement for Justice. His new organization was growing rapidly, drawing followers who believed in his vision of unity across racial and cultural lines. But as the nation teetered on the brink of change, Jeremiah found himself facing some of the greatest challenges of his life: the rise of the Unity Movement. In just 2 years, the Unity Movement for Justice had grown from an idea into a formidable organization. Its headquarters in Philadelphia buzzed with activity as volunteers organized marches, drafted educational programs, and trained community leaders. Jeremiah's speeches had evolved, blending his fiery passion with a message of reconciliation. "Our struggles are interconnected," Jeremiah declared at a rally in Chicago. "When one community is oppressed, we are all oppressed. Our freedom is tied to the freedom of every man and woman, no matter their race, religion, or background." This inclusive approach drew widespread support, but also sparked controversy. Some accused Jeremiah of abandoning the fight for black empowerment by advocating for unity with other groups. Malik Graham, his former ally from the Brotherhood of Freedom, was among his harshest critics. "You're selling out, Jeremiah," Malik said during a chance encounter in New York City. "You're diluting the fight. This isn't about unity. It's about survival. And survival means standing with our own." Jeremiah's voice remained calm but firm. "Survival isn't enough, Malik. We're fighting for something bigger: dignity, equality, and justice for everyone. That's the only way we win." Their conversation ended in disagreement, a painful reminder of the rift that had formed between them, a nation in turmoil. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy in November 1963 marked a turning point for the nation. The shocking act of violence left the country reeling, and the civil rights movement found itself at a critical juncture. Jeremiah, like many others, was deeply shaken by the assassination. During a press conference in Washington, a reporter asked him for his thoughts on the tragedy. Jeremiah's response was measured but controversial. "President Kennedy's death is a symptom of the violence that has plagued this country since its founding," he said. "America's chickens are coming home to roost. Until we confront the root causes of this violence, poverty, inequality, and systemic racism, it will continue to haunt us." The statement sparked outrage among some, who accused Jeremiah of insensitivity. Critics labeled him as unpatriotic, and several sponsors withdrew their support from the Unity Movement. For Jeremiah, the backlash was a stark reminder of the precarious line he walked as a leader, a crisis of faith. Amid the external pressures, Jeremiah faced a growing internal struggle. The weight of leadership, the relentless attacks from critics, and the constant surveillance by the FBI began to take a toll on his spirit. He found himself questioning whether he was truly making a difference or simply fighting an unwinnable battle. One night, during a rare moment of solitude, Jeremiah confided in Diane. They sat together in their small living room, the flicker of a candle casting soft shadows on the walls. "Sometimes I wonder if it's all worth it," Jeremiah admitted, his voice heavy with exhaustion. "I've lost friends, made enemies, and put our family at risk. And for what? The world doesn't seem to change." Diane took his hand, her gaze steady. "Change doesn't happen overnight, Jeremiah. It happens one person at a time, one step at a time. You've already inspired so many people. Don't let the doubts win." Her words gave Jeremiah a renewed sense of purpose. He resolved to keep pushing forward, even in the face of overwhelming odds. The pilgrimage to Mecca. In early 1964, Jeremiah embarked on a pilgrimage to Mecca, a journey he had long dreamed of making. The experience proved transformative, opening his eyes to the diversity and unity of the Muslim world. For the first time, he prayed alongside people of all races and nationalities, witnessing a level of equality and brotherhood he had never seen before. In Mecca, Jeremiah met scholars and leaders who encouraged him to adopt a broader perspective on his work. They spoke of the universality of justice and the need to build bridges between communities. The experience deepened Jeremiah's faith and reshaped his vision for the unity movement. When he returned to the United States, he addressed a crowd of supporters in Philadelphia, sharing the lessons he had learned. "I have seen what is possible when we put aside our differences and come together as one human family," he said. "It is not enough to fight for the rights of one group. We must fight for the rights of all." The founding of a new organization. Jeremiah's pilgrimage marked a turning point in his leadership. Inspired by his experiences in Mecca, he founded a new initiative within the Unity Movement, the Council for Universal Justice. The council focused on fostering dialogue between communities, organizing interfaith events, and addressing issues like poverty and education that affected people of all backgrounds. The council's first major initiative was a campaign to improve literacy in underserved communities. Volunteers organized reading programs, distributed books, and partnered with schools to provide resources for students. The campaign was a resounding success, earning praise from educators and activists alike. Growing threats. Jeremiah's growing influence did not go unnoticed by his enemies. The FBI intensified its efforts to discredit him, planting false rumors and infiltrating his organization. Meanwhile, former allies from the Brotherhood of Freedom saw his new vision as a betrayal and began openly denouncing him. The most chilling threats came from anonymous letters and phone calls warning Jeremiah to abandon his work. One night, as he prepared for bed, the phone rang. Diane answered, her face pale as she listened to the voice on the other end. "They said they're coming for you," she whispered after hanging up. Jeremiah's jaw tightened, but his resolve remained unshaken. "Let them come," he said. "They can't kill the truth." The turning point. Despite the mounting threats, Jeremiah continued to push forward, determined to expand the reach of the Unity Movement. His speeches grew more powerful, his vision more inclusive. Yet, he couldn't ignore the growing danger that surrounded him. In December 1964, during a rally in Selma, Alabama, Jeremiah addressed a crowd of thousands. His voice carried over the sea of faces, filled with both hope and urgency. "We stand at the edge of a great change," he said. "But change requires courage. It requires sacrifice. And it requires all of us, black, white, rich, poor, to come together and demand a better world. We cannot wait for justice to come to us. We must create it ourselves." The rally was a triumph, but Jeremiah knew that the road ahead would only grow more treacherous. The turning point had arrived, and there was no turning back. Chapter 10, Pilgrimage and Revelation. In the spring of 1964, Jeremiah X embarked on a journey that would forever alter the course of his life and his mission. His pilgrimage to Mecca, a cornerstone of his spiritual faith, became a transformative experience, not just in religious terms, but as a revelation about the potential for human unity. The man who returned to the United States was profoundly changed. His vision expanded beyond the borders of race and nation. The journey to Mecca. Jeremiah had long dreamed of making the Hajj, the sacred pilgrimage to Mecca. The teachings of Islam had become central to his life during his incarceration, and now, he yearned to experience its deepest truths firsthand. The Unity Movement's council members and his wife, Diane, encouraged him to take the trip, understanding its importance to his soul and his work. The journey was arduous. Jeremiah traveled through unfamiliar lands, facing language barriers and navigating the logistics of an international pilgrimage. But as he approached Mecca, the hardships melted away, replaced by awe and anticipation. When he entered the holy city, the sight of the Kaaba, the sacred center of Islam, brought tears to his eyes. Pilgrims from around the world surrounded him, their diverse faces and languages a testament to the unity he had always longed for, a revelation of equality. In Mecca, Jeremiah prayed alongside men and women of every race, nationality, and social status. The sheer diversity of the pilgrims astounded him. For the first time, he witnessed a world where the divisions that had plagued his life seemed irrelevant. In his journal, Jeremiah wrote, "Here, under the eyes of God, I am not black, nor am I oppressed. I am simply a man among men, a soul among souls, united in faith and purpose. This is what humanity could be, if only we allowed it." One evening, he sat with a group of scholars from various countries. They spoke of justice, equality, and the role of faith in fostering peace. One elder, a man from Turkey, leaned toward Jeremiah and said, "The struggle for justice is not the burden of one people, but the responsibility of all people. You are not alone in your fight." Those words resonated deeply with Jeremiah, reaffirming his belief that his mission needed to transcend the barriers of race and nation. The lessons of Mecca. During his stay, Jeremiah adopted a broader perspective on his work. He realized that while his fight for racial equality in America was essential, it was part of a larger global struggle against injustice and oppression. This realization gave him a renewed sense of purpose and a more inclusive vision for the Unity Movement. Before leaving Mecca, he wrote an open letter to his followers in the United States. In it, he described his experiences and the profound impact they had on his beliefs. "I have seen a world where the color of one's skin is as insignificant as the color of one's eyes. Here in Mecca, I have prayed beside kings and peasants, black and white, Eastern and Western. This experience has shown me that true equality is not a dream. It is a reality that we must strive to create." A new vision. When Jeremiah returned to the United States, he was greeted by a mix of curiosity and skepticism. His message had evolved, moving beyond the Black Liberation Movement to encompass a broader vision of human unity. While many embraced his new perspective, others accused him of abandoning the fight for Black empowerment. At a press conference in New York City, Jeremiah addressed the criticisms directly. "My vision has not changed," he said. "I still fight for the dignity and equality of Black people in America, but I have seen that our struggle is not unique. Oppression wears many faces, and if we are to defeat it, we must unite across all boundaries, racial, religious, and national." The press conference sparked a national debate, with commentators alternately praising and condemning Jeremiah's new approach. For Jeremiah, the backlash was expected, but it didn't deter him. He believed that the path forward required courage, even if it meant alienating some of his supporters. Reforming the Unity Movement. Jeremiah's experiences in Mecca inspired significant changes within the Unity Movement for Justice. He introduced a new initiative called the Council for Global Solidarity, which sought to connect the organization with activists and leaders from around the world. The council organized international conferences, inviting speakers from Africa, Asia, and the Middle East to share their perspectives on justice and equality. At one such conference in Washington, D.C., Jeremiah delivered a keynote address that outlined his expanded vision. "The fight for justice is not confined to our streets or our borders," he said. "It is a global battle, fought in every land where people are oppressed. We must see ourselves as part of a greater whole, united by our shared humanity and our shared struggle." The conference was a success, drawing attention to the Unity Movement's international reach. For Jeremiah, it was a validation of the lessons he had learned in Mecca. Personal struggles. Despite his successes, Jeremiah faced growing challenges at home. The FBI's surveillance of the Unity movement intensified, with agents attempting to discredit him through planted rumors and smear campaigns. Former allies from the Brotherhood of Freedom continued to criticize him, accusing him of abandoning black nationalism in favor of a diluted message of unity. The strain began to take a toll on Jeremiah's family life. Diane, who had always been his rock, struggled with the constant threats and public scrutiny. One evening, as they sat together after putting the children to bed, she voiced her fears. "Every time you walk out that door, I wonder if you'll come back," she said, her voice trembling. "I believe in what you're doing, Jeremiah, but I'm scared." Jeremiah took her hands in his eyes filled with both determination and regret. "I'm scared too, Diane. But if we give in to that fear, they win. And I can't let that happen." Their conversation deepened Jeremiah's resolve to protect his family while continuing his work. He knew the risks, but he also knew that the stakes were too high to turn back. The turning point. As 1964 drew to a close, Jeremiah's influence reached its peak. His speeches drew massive crowds, his vision inspired movements across the nation, and his name became synonymous with the fight for justice. Yet he also sensed the growing danger around him. The threats, both external and internal, were escalating, and he knew that his journey was far from over. One evening, as he prepared for yet another rally, Jeremiah paused to reflect on the path he had walked. From the fields of Ohio to the streets of Boston, from the cold walls of prison to the sacred grounds of Mecca, his life had been a series of trials and transformations. Now, as he stood on the precipice of a new era, he felt both the weight of his past and the promise of his future. With a deep breath, he stepped onto the stage, ready to face whatever lay ahead. Chapter 11, The Final Stand. By early 1965, Jeremiah X had reached the height of his influence and the edge of peril. His growing vision for unity, justice, and reconciliation had inspired a movement that transcended race and nation. Yet, it also made him a target for enemies on all fronts. His rejection of militant nationalism alienated former allies, while his calls for global solidarity threatened powerful institutions. The storm brewing around Jeremiah was no longer avoidable. It was a countdown to a clash he couldn't escape, a home under fire. The threats against Jeremiah and his family intensified with each passing day. His refusal to back down, combined with his sharp critiques of systemic oppression, made him a polarizing figure. The FBI increased its efforts to discredit him, spreading false rumors that he had betrayed the Unity movement and was colluding with foreign governments. Meanwhile, former members of the Brotherhood of Freedom accused him of abandoning the Black Liberation cause. One cold January morning, Jeremiah woke to the acrid smell of smoke. Running to the front of their modest home in Philadelphia, he found the remnants of a firebomb smoldering on their porch. Diane and the children, shaken but unharmed, stood in the doorway. "We can't stay here," Diane said, her voice trembling. "It's not safe anymore." Jeremiah nodded, his jaw tightening. He knew she was right, but the attack only strengthened his resolve. "They can burn down our house," he said, "but they can't destroy the truth." A gathering storm. The Unity Movement's headquarters became Jeremiah's de facto home as his family relocated to a safer location. Despite the constant threats, he continued to lead rallies, organize initiatives, and speak to ever-growing crowds. His message was more urgent than ever. In February 1965, he addressed a packed auditorium in Detroit, delivering what many would later call his most powerful speech. "They want us to believe we're powerless," he declared. "But power comes from unity, from discipline, from standing together, even when they try to tear us apart. Our fight is not just for ourselves, but for generations yet unborn." The audience erupted in applause, their cheers echoing long after Jeremiah left the stage. Yet, even in that moment of triumph, Jeremiah knew the cost of his defiance. The more he spoke, the closer his enemies crept. A betrayal confirmed. The fractures within the Unity movement deepened as tensions escalated. Some members, influenced by outside forces, began questioning Jeremiah's leadership. Malik Graham, once a close ally, became a vocal critic, accusing Jeremiah of compromising the movement's original goals. At a private council meeting, Malik confronted Jeremiah directly. "You've turned your back on the people who believed in you," he said. "This isn't about unity anymore. It's about your ego." Jeremiah remained calm but firm. "This has never been about me, Malik. It's about justice. And justice isn't just for one group of people. It's for all of us. If you can't see that, then maybe you've lost your way." The meeting ended in a bitter divide, with several members of the council walking out. Jeremiah felt the sting of betrayal, but refused to waver. "The truth is never easy to follow," he told Diane that evening. "But it's the only path worth walking." The final threat. The threats became more personal as February wore on. Anonymous letters and phone calls warned Jeremiah to stop his work or face dire consequences. One night, as he prepared for bed in his office at the headquarters, the phone rang. The voice on the other end was calm but chilling. "You've gone too far, Jeremiah," the caller said. "Your time is up." Jeremiah hung up without responding, his mind racing. He knew the end was near, but he refused to let fear dictate his actions. Instead, he focused on preparing for his next major event, a rally at the Unity Ballroom in Harlem. "This is where I need to be," he told his closest advisors. "No matter what happens, the people need to hear the truth. The day of reckoning." On February 21, 1965, Jeremiah arrived at the Unity Ballroom for what would be his final rally. The air was thick with anticipation as hundreds of supporters packed the hall, eager to hear him speak. Security was tight, but Jeremiah knew it might not be enough. He had seen the shadows closing in for weeks, yet he walked to the podium with unshakable resolve. He began his speech with the same fire that had defined his career. "We stand at a crossroads," he said, his voice echoing through the room. "The forces of oppression want us to believe that we're powerless. But we are not powerless. We are powerful beyond measure, if only we stand together." As the crowd erupted in applause, chaos struck. A commotion erupted near the entrance, followed by the deafening crack of gunfire. Jeremiah's bodyguards rushed to shield him, but it was too late. He was struck multiple times, collapsing to the stage as the crowd screamed and scattered. One of the assailants, later identified as a former Brotherhood member, was subdued by the crowd and arrested. Jeremiah was rushed to a nearby hospital, but the injuries were too severe. At 8:45 p.m., he was pronounced dead. The aftermath. Jeremiah X's assassination sent shockwaves through the nation. His supporters mourned the loss of a leader who had dared to dream of a better world, while his critics grappled with the implications of his death. Thousands attended his funeral, where leaders from various movements paid tribute to his life and legacy. At the service, Diane delivered a eulogy that captured the essence of Jeremiah's journey. "He was a man who refused to be defined by fear," she said, her voice steady despite her grief. "He believed in the power of truth, even when it cost him everything. And though he is gone, his dream lives on in all of us, a legacy of hope." In the months and years following Jeremiah's death, the Unity Movement for Justice continued to grow, fueled by the passion and principles he had instilled in its members. His writings and speeches became rallying cries for a new generation of activists, inspiring movements around the world. Though his life was cut short, Jeremiah X's impact endured. He had shown that the fight for justice was not confined to one race or one nation, but was a universal struggle that demanded courage, sacrifice, and unwavering faith. His story became a symbol of resilience, a reminder that even in the face of the greatest darkness, the light of truth could never be extinguished. Chapter 12. Legacy of Hope. Jeremiah X's death on February 21, 1965, was a devastating blow to his family, his followers, and the larger struggle for justice. Yet, in the wake of his assassination, his vision and legacy only grew stronger, inspiring movements across the nation and around the world. The man who had once been a wayward youth in Ohio had become a symbol of resilience, courage, and the relentless pursuit of equality. A nation mourns. The days following Jeremiah's assassination were marked by an outpouring of grief. Vigils were held in cities across the country, with thousands gathering to honor his life and work. At his funeral in Philadelphia, leaders from diverse communities spoke of his impact. Dr. Samuel Brooks, a prominent civil rights leader and longtime supporter of the unity movement, delivered a powerful eulogy. "Jeremiah X showed us that the fight for justice is not a sprint but a marathon," he said. "He reminded us that true change comes not from violence, but from the strength of our convictions and the unity of our purpose." Diane stood beside her children as the funeral procession moved through the streets. Despite her grief, she held her head high, knowing that Jeremiah's dream lived on. The Unity Movement's next chapter. After Jeremiah's death, the Unity Movement for Justice faced a critical juncture. Without its charismatic leader, some feared the organization would falter. But the principles Jeremiah had instilled in its members, discipline, unity, and a commitment to truth, proved stronger than any individual. Under Diane's quiet yet resolute leadership, the Unity Movement restructured itself into a network of local chapters, each dedicated to continuing Jeremiah's work. The Council for Global Solidarity, which he had founded after his pilgrimage to Mecca, became a cornerstone of the movement, fostering partnerships with activists and organizations worldwide. One of the movement's most successful initiatives was the Jeremiah X Education Fund, established in his honor to provide scholarships, mentorship, and resources for underprivileged students. The fund helped thousands of young people achieve their dreams, fulfilling Jeremiah's vision of empowerment through education. The power of words. Jeremiah's speeches and writings took on a life of their own after his death. His words, preserved in recordings, letters, and journals, became rallying cries for a new generation of activists. Schools and community centers across the country hosted readings of his speeches, ensuring that his message would never be forgotten. One passage, often quoted, became a symbol of hope. "They can silence a voice, but they cannot silence an idea. They can destroy a body, but they cannot destroy a dream. The fight for justice is eternal, and it belongs to all of us." This enduring message resonated far beyond America's borders. Activists in South Africa, India, and beyond cited Jeremiah's teachings as a source of inspiration in their own struggles for freedom, a family strength. For Diane and her children, life after Jeremiah's death was both a challenge and a testament to their resilience. Samuel, the eldest, followed in his father's footsteps, becoming a lawyer dedicated to fighting for civil rights. Lila, inspired by her father's advocacy for education, became a teacher and later a principal, shaping the lives of countless students. Diane continued to serve as a quiet force within the Unity Movement, ensuring that Jeremiah's vision remained at the heart of its mission. In interviews and speeches, she often reflected on the sacrifices they had made as a family. "We gave up so much," she said during a televised interview years later. But Jeremiah believed that the fight for justice was bigger than any one of us. And in his memory, we've made it our mission to keep that fight alive, a symbol of hope. As the years passed, Jeremiah X became an enduring symbol of hope and resilience. Streets, schools, and community centers were named in his honor, and his life story was taught in classrooms as a testament to the power of transformation and the importance of standing up for what is right. In 1985, on the 20th anniversary of his death, a statue of Jeremiah X was unveiled in Philadelphia's Unity Square, depicting him mid-speech, his hand raised in determination. The ceremony drew attendees from all walks of life, united in their admiration for a man who had given everything for the cause of justice. Diane, now in her 60s, stood before the crowd and spoke with the same quiet strength that had carried her through the years. "Jeremiah's dream was never about him," she said. "It was about all of us, the oppressed, the forgotten, the hopeful. Today, we honor him not by looking back, but by continuing to move forward, a global legacy." Jeremiah's impact extended far beyond the United States. His vision of global solidarity inspired movements around the world, from the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa to the fight for workers' rights in Latin America. Leaders across continents cited his teachings as a blueprint for building inclusive, just societies. In 1990, the United Nations recognized Jeremiah X as a global hero for justice, a posthumous honor acknowledging his contributions to human rights. The award was accepted by Samuel, who spoke of his father's unwavering commitment to the universal principles of equality and dignity. The eternal flame. Jeremiah X's life was a testament to the power of transformation. From a boy who had lost everything to a man who gave his all, his journey inspired millions to believe in the possibility of a better world. His death, though tragic, became a catalyst for change, proving that while individuals may perish, their ideals endure. In every march, every rally, and every act of defiance against injustice, Jeremiah's spirit lived on. He had shown the world that courage could light even the darkest paths, and that hope, once kindled, could never be extinguished. As the sun set on the day of the statue's unveiling, Diane and her family stood quietly, gazing at the likeness of the man they had loved and lost. Around them, the crowd began to disperse, their voices carrying Jeremiah's message into the night. And in that moment, Diane knew. Jeremiah's legacy wasn't just etched in stone. It was alive in the hearts of the people, a flame that would burn for generations to come.